It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. He's the author of 7 books of poetry. He's been published in The New Yorker, several literary journals. He's a past winner of the National Poetry Series competition, as well as the Pushcart Prize. He's been living in and writing about Pittsburgh his whole life. He's Robert Gibb. Robert, welcome to the confluence. Good to have you here.
Nice to be here.
The obvious first question is, how did you first get interested in writing poetry? Was there someone, another writer, another poet that inspired you? What was it?
Was the early 60s and probably songwriters.
Anybody in particular?
Well, I guess like most people at that time, early on, Dylan, who was going back to Woody Guthrie and a lot of his predecessors. And even the pop scene at that time had more interesting
lyrics.
Well, yeah, lyrics and the animals, the British song, House of the Rising Sun, was an old folk song.
So it sounds like a lot of folk was inspired you.
Yeah, folk and urban blues.
Poetry, correct me if I'm wrong, is often associated with nature, human emotions, behavior. But your writing often has focused on industry, the steel mills and furnaces. How did you first start at finding inspiration in these traditional, these old, even harsh environments?
Well, that happened, that kind of snuck up on me because I was living rural at that time. And most of what I was writing was in that romantic tradition of nature and Wordsworth and Keats. And not that I was writing anything close to what they did. And then every once in a while, these other things would start to be creeping in, which were basically mill settings and stuff. So it took me a while and in a kind of indirection for that to, because I thought I had sort of left that behind for a more rural farmland.
But that family history of being involved in the steelworking sort of helped it, pushed it to creep back in or what?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I was a slow learner, so it took me for a while to see that I had a life that could also be worked with.
How did you come to realize that here you have this industry, but there was so much impact on people of this region, but that you wanted to write about it?
I think the subjects choose you, unless something amazing in its impact and its immediacy happens, where it clears out space and displaces. The other stuff kind of comes at its own time and its own impetus, and you're just in a way there to be responsive or alert to whenever that happens. But growing up, I can remember grade school, teacher pointing down the hill to the steel mills in Homestead, saying, well, there's the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah.
So, and then my grandfather died in the mill, so I had a long history, personal and also cultural, that were Homestead-based and connected to the mills.
You said it sort of finds you. Did you avoid it at all for a while or not?
No, but you can't. This wasn't exactly what he was talking about, but Yeats makes an observation somewhere that the will can't do the work of the imagination. So you can want to, but that doesn't get you very far. So the will, I mean, you can want to write about this or you can think about that, but it's not till this other kind of wake-up call comes through that the connection's made.
You've brought a poem with you.
I did.
That I'd like you to read. What is the name of this poem and where is it from?
Okay, it's called The Hall of Architecture, and it's the Hall of Architecture in the Carnegie Museum in Oakland.
Well, if you would, please read it for us.
There in the past's attic, we stop before plinths and entablatures, caryatids topped with their vast crowns, a pair of cupids bearing small stone wings, all of it hoarded in that hall whose remnants we ranged among, dwarfed by portals and urns, the castings of the great doors of a baptistry where every panel disgorged its throng. Even the radiators seemed monumental. You found such maleness smothering, marble and bronze being brunted by the will. I remembered the mills when molten steel poured into molds. Slag rose like coral reefs. The scale of that labor now hard to conceive. But then this was my house of wonders while growing up. The horse of the sun surging from its stone, the horse of the moon setting, the great room's freight and plunder, as natural to me as the cliff wall rising along West Run Road, dates and names scrawled across its rocks. It was all the same, the lettered bluff, the museum's sheer vaults carted from their quarry. This was Pittsburgh, after all. I rode home on welded tracks, past open horse and dark purling rivers, buildings constructed out of granite blocks. For me, the past was an escarpment, something silent and shelved and permanent.
The Hall of Architecture by Robert Gibb. Robert, that poem, I believe, is part of what you call the Homestead Trilogy, three books, nearly 100 poem cycle, exploring industry and culture in Pittsburgh. This poem begins in the Carnegie Hall of Architecture, as you said, in Oakland. It transitions to a scene alongside Pittsburgh's mills, rivers. What is it about a museum space that spoke to you, that got you to write that?
Well, the museum, like the folk lyrics I talked of, referenced, was another inkling that there was a larger world outside of the one that I knew. And I used to hang out in Oakland. So that was just sort of a place for me that was, in an odd way, nurturing, even though it's got some cultural baggage, which isn't very pleasant when you think about it, which is what the word plunder in the poem is right. referring to.
Right. So whether it's this poem or any of your works regarding the steel industry, is there a fond remembrance, a lamenting, a passing, something else?
Yes and no. They were horrible in terms of the environment.
You mentioned your grandfather died in the steel mill.
Yeah, he fell off a scaffolding, broke his back. But, you know, growing up working class, I mean, there were unions and there were people that really fought for their – my grandfather was at the strike, the lockout in 1892 when the Pinkertons came ashore. Right. I knew right away when I went into the mills that I was overmatched. I mean, I knew it wasn't something that I was – meant for or was going to be able to handle very well. So I don't miss that part. But, you know, Jung says something interesting. He says that the soul responds to a kind of almost grotesque kind of imagery. And if you grew up when you were 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 years old, and it was like being in Gaza, I mean, with the pyramids and the Sphinx, I mean, these enormous elemental structures just towered over you and they burned all night long. I mean, it's just, you can't get that out of your system. It's for good or bad, it's just the presence that's just so astonishing. You know, and now I was saying about the teacher pointing to the Industrial Revolution. Now we've gone from that incredible size and mass and scaled on the turn of a dime down to the computer chip. And all that's now gone, you know, and with it a kind of sense of the body and connection of the body to the world. I mean, workers work with their bodies.
Right.
Computers are more cerebral. You work with concepts and that. And I think there's just a lot that's not there. So it's, as I say, it's a mixed blessing.
When you write poems that are tied to a specific place, do you write it on site, like in the case of the Hall of Architecture? Do you write it at the location of a former mill, or do you just sort of keep the image in mind and then write in your private writing space?
Wordsworth said that moments of emotion reflected in tranquility. If I know the place and it's familiar to me, then there's no reason to take notes. Then it's all kind of reflected. If it's not a place where I have a vocabulary or the details are at fingertips, then sometimes I write down some sense impressions, and then that all gets used later.
A lot of your writing, as I mentioned, the Homestead Trilogy does focus on what's man-made, but tell us about your more natural work, such as, you know, What the Heart Can Bear. What about nature inspires you?
There were woods behind my house when I was a boy, and I always had a kind of druidic sense of that as a sacred grove for whatever reason that was. And that's one of the things that stayed with me. Wilderness, I think, is an important space. Also, a lot of the poems in the collection you just identified have to do with gardens and outdoor work and farmland, where the work and the impact is of human beings on the landscape at its best is a lot less disruptive.
So what inspires you now? What gets you wanting to write, or is it what comes upon you and say, I have to write about this?
Well, again, unless something, you know, just enormous that just smacks you, you know, in the gob, it's more language. If sometimes a phrase will just pop up, or a couple syllables that rub up against each other in a way that create the right kind of beginning friction, shale being struck by flint, and then that's a toehold, and then that seems to be then generative, and it's a matter of just nursing that spark into something that's more sustained, which you go back to and then forward and back and forward until finally the poem starts to engage and take shape.
Robert Gibb is an award-winning poet living in Pittsburgh. Robert, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
This is The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, musician Prince launches his controversy tour at the Stanley Theater, now the Benedum, in 1981. The tour coincided with Prince's fourth studio album, Controversy. His set list at the Stanley included hits like I Wanna Be Your Lover, Sexuality, and Why You Wanna Treat Me So Bad. Prince would go on to tour cities across the country, ending in Cincinnati, Ohio in March. The tour also marked the debut of the group The Time, a longtime band that formed under Prince's contract in Minneapolis. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
I'm Megan Harris. Just ahead on The Confluence, one Butler County community is planning to celebrate the arrival of the InSight robotics lander on the face of Mars. Local leaders have been chatting with NASA ahead of the landing, but how did a small Pennsylvania town get linked up with the nation's top scientists in the first place? And how meaningful is any given vote if the candidate you cast a ballot for loses? That's the crux behind Pennsylvania's efficiency gap in the wake of congressional redistricting. Find this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence, plus wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
WESA celebrates 90 neighborhoods, 90 good stories, a weekly series about people who make the place they live a better place to live. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Today, we meet the leader of a Squirrel Hill organization working to build relationships in a diverse and changing neighborhood. 90.5 WESA's Brian Cook reports.
Squirrel Hill's strength is its people.
So says Marion Lien. She's the executive director of Squirrel Hill Urban Coalition. According to Lien, this relatively quiet section of Pittsburgh is culturally rich, close-knit, diverse, and forward-thinking in its approach toward making the neighborhood a great place to live.
The Realtors of America had voted Squirrel Hill as the most livable neighborhood in the United States. That in itself says something, right, about telling us that we're doing something right.
Celebrating 45 years, the Squirrel Hill Urban Coalition is a nonprofit organization serving as a public platform for neighborhood residents to come together and talk about the issues of the day.
And I can tell you that the something right is listening. listening to those who live here, listening to the residents, listening to the business owners, listening to those who are visiting.
Lien says part of its mission is to ensure safety and increasing the close-knit atmosphere by, among other things, expanding the shopping district, providing bus shelters, planting trees, installing new streetlights, and securing walkways, some of which are done by volunteers. Others are brought to fruition by way of grant funding.
The neighborhood is looking at the ratio and composition of housing to parking to marketability that we have. It is making sure that it is a walkable neighborhood, making sure that the sidewalks are going to be in place, particularly crosswalks if they are in existence, making sure that the markings are painted visibly.
Tucked away in the old Whiteman School community building on Solway Street, now titled the Carriage House, the building houses various programs for families in addition to childcare. In the wake of the mass shooting at Tree of Life Synagogue, which left 11 dead and several wounded on October 27th,
this has become a very personal attack.
Members of the Jewish faith were intentionally targeted in the massacre, and with Squirrel Hill being home to a large portion of Pittsburgh's Jewish community,
the scar that this will have left on our psyche is deep. Will it take time for the healing? Absolutely.
Lien describes how people came together in the face of adversity.
This community loves one another. There are those who have quietly tried to help healing without fanfare, without the limelight.
She says it is a testament to the resiliency of the neighborhood.
Because what has happened is a violation of a sort that is so painful, but we also know that we're stronger than that, and that if there is to be any good that comes out of this terrible, horrific experience, it is that we will come out of it to know that we have the know-how to build an even stronger safety net around us.
She says the key to a sound living space is the
desire to want to help one another. I really think is what is the secret to the success of a community.
I'm Brian Cook, 90.5 WESA News.
Who's making a difference in your neighborhood? Share your suggestion for our series WESA Celebrates 90 Neighborhoods, 90 Good Stories at WESA.FM/90. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. After nearly 7 months and 300 million miles, NASA's InSight mission craft is set to land on Mars shortly before 3 this afternoon Eastern Time, bound to be a celebration at NASA and the Jet Propulsion Lab, as well as in Mars, Butler County. Joining us by phone from the Jet Propulsion Lab in California is NASA's chief scientist, Jim Green. Welcome, Jim. Thanks for taking the time.
Oh, my pleasure. It's early in the morning here, so we're really getting geared up for a fabulous landing.
All right. And in studio to talk with you and our listeners about the borough's special relationship with NASA are Greg Hartung, the mayor of Mars, and Missy Graylish, the communications coordinator for the Planet Mars New Year celebration. Greg, Missy, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks
for having us.
Jim, I want to start with you. So after years of planning, months of space flight, we're just about 5 hours away from the landing. So what's the mood? Nervous, excited, confident?
All of that and more. You know, there's quite an era of excitement in terms of knowing that this is going to happen. There's nothing more we can do. Everything is on automatic, and we're waiting for the event to happen.
Didn't you just do something yesterday, a slight change a little bit?
Yeah, actually, we did it last night.
Okay.
Got it confirmed. It's just a little puff, almost like an exhale, and that should put the lander right square in the middle of what we call the landing ellipse. That's a projected area on the surface which is about 130 kilometers by 27 kilometers. It's a long ellipse where we expect it to sit down.
Now, Jim, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about this mission, but while you were talking about the excitement there, smiles on the faces of Greg and Missy here. Greg, you're smiling.
Right. Yeah, we started back on May 5th when he launched his mission with an event in Mars that had us all excited about when it would come to this day. So we're as excited as NASA is and JPL.
And Missy, we're going to talk more about the New Year celebration, but you're smiling as well about this eventful day.
I am. It's exciting. The correlation between NASA, the planet Mars, and the little town of Marsboro is so exciting for all of us.
So, Jim, I want to ask you, the last mission to Mars, the MAVEN was, I believe, in 2013-14. What's different about this mission and the InSight mission?
Well, MAVEN is an orbiter. MAVEN was all about looking at solar wind hitting the planet. Where it hits, of course, is the ionosphere, which is above the atmosphere. Mars has no magnetic field, so it doesn't have a magnetosphere. And so we want to know what that interaction is like. It's very different than the interaction of the solar wind and around the Earth. But this mission, InSight, will go to the ground. Now, it's a lander. It's not a rover. It's designed to sit down in a nice flat area, deploy a couple experiments. One is a seismic experiment. We believe Mars shakes. We have a number of evidence for that. And, of course, that's going to tell us with seismic data what the interior really looks like. How big is the core, the mantle, and the crust?
So you'll be studying Mars quakes?
We'll study Mars quakes, yeah.
So what do you, I mean, you'll learn about it, but what are the practical uses for this information?
Well, it'll tell us how these planets are put together, how terrestrial planets come together and how they evolve. We want to know in that core how much of it is liquid, how much of it is solid. We know Mars had a magnetic field in its past, generated primarily like the Earth, we assume, which is in that liquid upper part of the core. We want to know why Mars no longer generates its magnetic field. This is all about planetary evolution. But there's more to it than just that. You know, with humans on the surface of Mars in the future, if there are Mars quakes, we need to be able to understand them, build structures that will withstand those kind of quakes, and be able to work on another planet.
I want to ask more about this mission in just a couple of minutes. Greg, Missy, I wanted to get into when did the borough of Mars begin to identify with outer space so closely, and why so?
Actually, 2015, we had basically stopped celebrating because so many celebrations occur, like in Pittsburgh, for the traditional Earth New Year. So we got thinking outside the box a little bit and said, when is New Year's on the planet Mars? And someone says, well, you're the mayor, you find out. So I actually called the Jet Propulsion Lab and talked to Guy Webster in the public relations office. I said, Guy, how can you help me out? And he goes, let me get back to you. So he got back to me and he said, happens every 22 months and that the next one will be June 2015. And lo and behold, we had our first Mars New Year celebration on Earth in Mars, Pennsylvania.
All right. And so, Missy, I want to bring you in. So you've done these celebrations in the past. Is there anything that the Mars Borough is doing for this landing today? But also, just briefly tell us about the next Mars New Year in the spring.
Well, for the landing today, basically what we're doing is social media posting and tracking and following the whole progression of the landing itself. Now, as far as the Mars New Year is concerned, we kick off our events in March with our blast-off dinner, which Dr. Jim Green will be speaking, which is really exciting.
Yeah, Jim, why did you want to be a keynote at the blast-off dinner?
Well, it really turns out that we've been involved with Mars, Pennsylvania, when Greg called me and said, we have a celebration coming up. Would I be interested to visit Mars, Pennsylvania? I said, absolutely. So I think we brought at least 50 NASA employees, maybe more up there. Had a wonderful time. It's a beautiful small town. you know, I'm from a small town, and that look and feel, the downtown area, and the folks are just really wonderful, wonderful people. That was just such a perfect opportunity to continue our relationship.
Well, and Missy and Greg, it's not just about celebration, which it is. It's also a learning event or a series of learning events as well.
Absolutely. It's STEAM-based: science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. And so what we're doing is focusing on the community itself as well as our children and trying to educate them on future jobs.
Yeah,
and that the planet Mars and the science that goes with it brings a lot of things back to us here on Earth in terms of our living and our being able to have knowledge about everything that's scientific and technologically driven.
Right. And Jim, you mentioned it was, you know, a great small time in the town and the atmosphere. But talk a little bit about the importance of NASA's role in sort of, you know, sort of inspiring young people to learn about science and specifically learn about space.
Well, you're indeed correct. It's really a perfect opportunity to talk to kids. When we came up for the first celebration, we brought some rovers. We had a wonderful time. I had a little boy that followed me around most of the day. I gave him my card, and about 6 months later, his father sent me an email, told me how his son has really turned on, doing well in school. He comes home, he builds spacecraft out of Legos. He loves NASA, loves science, and he thanked me for the gravity assist.
Oh,
now, as a planetary term, I really got that. That really meant something to me, and I understand exactly what that's all about. It never occurred to me that as a NASA employee, I could give gravity assist like that to kids. And that's really got me inspired.
And we have just about 3 minutes left, and I'm going to get one more question to you, Jim, but also to Greg and Missy. Some other the key events that are coming up for the Mars New Year.
Sure. We have the STEAM Education Breakfast at the Regional Learning Alliance. That'll be on March 22nd, and Dr. Green will be speaking there and presenting to, we're looking at high school students, maybe to early college age. We have our Mars New Year event, which is our major exploration, innovation, and celebration event. That'll occur on Friday, May 31st, with a big, huge celebration in downtown Mars, Saturday, June 1st, and Sunday, June 2nd. And it'll be followed up by our fundraiser, Brewfest, in downtown Mars on June 15th.
And, Greg, I want to get you to chime in on this. How important are these events? It's not just, as I said, a celebration. It's a whole learning. It's a community event, series of events.
Right, a series of events that actually involves a cross-section of people from various organizations, the school district and other school districts, too, in the area, to be really involved with what it means to be educated here after, you know, the year 2000 into the millennium that we're now experiencing.
All right. In our minute and a half or so remaining, Jim, I wanted to ask you, how long is the InSight mission, and how long is it until humans are able to step onto Mars? So how long is this mission?
Well, this mission is designed to last one Mars year. It may last longer, but we're pointing towards the opportunity for the planet to go completely around the sun. This enables us to really thoroughly see what the gravitational tugs and pulls are all about. We expect even Jupiter to have perhaps a little effect on the planet and maybe generate a series of earthquakes from that interaction. Now, how long that is, that's about two Earth years.
Okay.
So, 680 or so days, it allows us wonderful opportunities to really study the interior of the planet.
In our last 30 seconds or so, obviously you and your colleagues and Greg and Missy in the studio here, they're excited about the possibility of humans stepping foot on Mars. Is that realistic? And if so, when?
I'd like to see it in my lifetime. NASA's moving in that direction in many different ways. We're building the rocket capability to do that. We're starting also a program that enables us to live and work on a planetary surface for the very first time by using the moon in that way. That enables us then to test a variety of technologies and get back to Mars with humans for the first time in the late 30s, perhaps early 40s, 2040.
All right. Jim Green is NASA's chief scientist. Jim, thanks so much for joining us on this very busy and celebratory day, and best of luck.
Thank you so much.
Greg Hartung is the mayor of Mars Borough. Missy Graylish is the communications coordinator for the Planet Mars New Year celebration. Thanks to both of you for coming in.
Thanks for having us, Kevin.
And you're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Some statisticians calculate the fairness of congressional maps using something called an efficiency gap. It's a formula meant to assess how meaningful people's votes are in each party. So with the midterms in Pennsylvania now over, just how efficient was your vote? Joining us to assess the party advantage is Mike Wershagen, an investigative reporter for the Harrisburg-based newspaper, The Caucus. Mike, good to have you back on the show.
Great to be back.
Mike, without getting too deep in the weeds, how's the formula work? What is it telling us?
It's what it tells us is how efficiently each party converts votes into seats. Basically, how much does your vote matter if you're a Republican or if you're a Democrat? And the formula, when you first take a look at it, looks a bit daunting unless, you know, you really spend your off hours, you know, playing with algebra.
Right.
But it's not that tough. It's essentially any wasted vote is a vote cast for either A, a losing candidate, or B, for a winning candidate above the one vote that person needed to win.
Mm-hmm.
So then what you do is you take those wasted votes for each party. You subtract the, you know, one from the other, and then you divide it by the total number of votes, and that gives you a percentage. That's your efficiency gap.
Wasted votes.
That's a term that the statisticians who came up with this use. It's not a value judgment. If you vote for a candidate, and when election day rolls around, everybody should vote, of course. Your vote is not wasted, except in this statistical model. That's just a term they apply to it.
Okay, so we know after the midterms a couple of weeks ago that the congressional delegation will be 9-9, 9 Dems, 9 Republicans, come January when they take the oath of office. The Republican margin is now gone. So, but in your analysis, you indicate the GOP still maintains a significant advantage in the newly drawn map that the state Supreme Court ordered. How so?
Right. It's not the same advantage that they used to have.
Okay.
So when you apply the formula to the 2012 map, the map that was first used in 2012 that allowed Republicans to win, let's see, we had 18 seats. I think it was a 9-5, or I'm sorry, 13-5 split.
About a year ago, yeah.
Yeah. So 13-5 split under the previous map. The Supreme Court, state Supreme Court, took a look at that and said, this is way out of whack. There is just, it's just not a fair map. There is no way that Democrats could compete in this. And it was drawn specifically to give one party an advantage over the other. That was a violation of the Free and Fair Elections Clause in the Constitution. So that efficiency gap was about 24%. Now, you multiply the number of seats, 18, by 24%, you get a gap of 4.3-something seats. So essentially, this map gave Republicans 4 seats that in a perfectly fair world, they would not have won.
Well, is that based on if they were elected statewide as opposed to districts?
Right, and that's the issue here. It's almost impossible to draw a perfectly even map. And a lot of people would tell you that that shouldn't be the goal anyway. That's not really what you're trying to do here. You're trying to get people with like interests, like lifestyles, things like that, to elect representatives who will look out for their common interests.
So people choose to live in a place for all kinds of reasons, job, family, amenities, climate. But one of those factors is politically like-minded individuals.
There is some of that. There's a lot of research out there about, you know, and there's a bit of a debate over whether this is this sorting, this self-sorting that we do is because we want to live with people who have the same political beliefs or because people who want to live a certain lifestyle, say, in a city, because of why they want to live there, share certain political beliefs. It's kind of a chicken and egg thing right now. But there are an awful lot of reasons why people choose to live together and in similar areas. Now, generally, you have Democrats clustered in cities. You have Republicans spread out in rural areas.
Right.
And that's where Republicans end up keeping their advantage, even in this redrawn map. It's because these tight clusters of Democrats, you have Democrats racking up huge, huge margins. They're winning by 80%, sometimes more. Congressman Doyle, who represents Pittsburgh, didn't have an opponent.
Mm-hmm. So hence the, quote, wasted votes.
Right.
Those
right.
big margins.
Exactly. And so while Democrats are in these tightly packed districts, Republican districts are much more broadly, much more widely spread, and they include these pockets of Democratic voters like, say, Lancaster City, which is in the middle of a very large congressional district. So that right. Republican advantage, then, they win by smaller margins, but they still pick up more of these seats.
Okay. When districts are divided according to geography, maybe common interests rather than for partisan advantage, does who the candidates are become more important, per se?
It does, yeah. All of a sudden, the letter behind your name, the D or the R, matters a little bit less if the district is competitive, if it's a place where you actually have to present your ideas to the electorate and where there's a nice even split. So if you sway a few voters from the other party, you sway the election. And that does a lot of things. One of the things it does, some social and political scientists will tell you, is that it makes these representatives more responsive to their constituents and less responsive to, say, their leaders in either Washington or Harrisburg, because the voters ultimately are the people that can decide this. It's not a safe district for you. Another thing it does is it encourages more participation. We saw a huge number of women starting to get involved in these races, and it's because they were no longer, in a lot of cases, they could see a path to victory. These districts were not drawn for, the man who had occupied the seat or the person that man was grooming, which is also often a man, to succeed him. And so with a competitive race, you get more of these candidates and you get this more dynamic democratic process.
And of course, four women won U.S. House seats from Pennsylvania earlier this month.
Went from zero to four.
Okay, we have just about a minute and a half or so left. So you said the D and the R beside the name. But I want to ask you, what about the role of independent voters in your analysis? Is there a factor in there?
Yeah, absolutely. The analysis is not based on the party of the candidate necessarily. It's based on the voters who gave that candidate their vote.
Right.
There could be some of these wasted Democratic votes could be Republican voters who wasted their votes on behalf of a Democrat. And again, wasted, not a value
right.
judgment. Go vote when you get a chance. But it just matters which side got the support. And as long as you can, if you can reach across the aisle and you can get somebody else's support, if you can get an independent support, then that's going to, obviously help. And in these more competitive districts, that matters much, much more. If you're an independent, if you're a swing voter, these are the districts where you really do make the most difference.
Very quickly now, 30 seconds less. So you mentioned competitive races. Are we going to expect more hotly contested races? Are they going to continue, do you think?
I think so. And we're also going to be seeing another round of redistricting coming up. And so this issue that people have put a lot of effort into, people have put a lot of, effort in trying to get more people involved and engaged in the redistricting process, we're going to see that continue. And after the next census, these districts that were drawn for this race, they're gone. They're going to have to be redone again. So we're going to be back talking about this exact same thing in the next couple of years.
Okay. Mike Wershagen is an investigative reporter for the Harrisburg-based newspaper, The Caucus. Mike, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next program, we'll talk with the FBI special agent in charge of the Pittsburgh office about major investigations, such as the mass shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistants from Meg Fair and Mick Stanelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.